On through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
This is Will Bruzzo.
And this is Sean Fagot.
And we're from The Aggressive Moderate.
The political show where we don't agree on anything.
But we agree on one thing.
Supporting KUCI through your generous contributions.
From April 26th to May 10th, you will have the opportunity to contribute to KUCI by calling 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI, or going to KUCI.org and following the prompts to contribute.
Donate today.
And listen to The Aggressive Moderate every Thursday at 5 p.m.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at KUCI.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett. As always, Writers on Writing brings you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, and publishers. And I'm fortunate enough to be joined this morning by critically acclaimed short story writer Tobias Wolff. And coming up in the second half hour, John Burnham Schwartz will be with me talking about his latest novel, The Commoner. Tobias Wolff is the author of seven previous books and the editor of The Vintage Book for American Short Stories. Among his authors are the Penn Malmud Award and the Rhea Award, both for excellence in the short story, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and the Penn Faulkner Award. He teaches at Stanford, and it is his latest book of short stories, the first collection in over a decade, including 10 new stories and 21 classics that we'll be discussing this morning. Mr. Wolf, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. I was reading a bit about how you originally came to writing, and there was mention of your father and some of the impacts he may have had on you. They said he was quite a creative storyteller, and perhaps a exaggerated storyteller, and perhaps how he was influenced on you becoming a writer. Was that the case, that kind of the art and practice of storytelling was very much of an organic part of your upbringing?
Well, my father certainly was a storyteller. He had a great sense of character and narrative. Unfortunately, a lot of the stories he told as true weren't true. But yeah, there were a lot of stories in our house and when I was growing up. I don't know, though, to tell you the truth, that having someone who tells stories as a parent necessarily creates a road to being a writer. It's such a different thing, and so many writers have come out of homes where people didn't tell stories, where there was a kind of flatness in the daily life, that their own storytelling was probably a form of protest against or an attempt to find some life, create some life where there was none. Mm. So, I don't think that my father's storytelling was any kind of destiny for me, but it may have had some influence.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was noticing that there was a thread of kind of a common recurring theme of lying and kind of exploring the boundaries of truth telling in a lot of the stories that you wrote. And I was wondering if this kind of reverberates around in your head when you're writing that theme.
It must, because it does show up in a lot of the stories. I don't set out to write a story about falsity and duplicity when I sit down to write necessarily. It's so much a part of our character. We're self-conscious animals, and as such, we do tend to perform to put on a kind of act for others, and even as we do that, we're aware of it, and it creates in all of us, at one time or another, and to various degrees, a sense of duplicity, of doubleness, if you will. We tend, I think, somewhat to watch ourselves and to control our performance, and the thoughtful person inevitably is led to, I think, a question about, his own authenticity at some point. That kind of obsession does show up in the stories now and then, there's no question about it.
Yeah. And there's also kind of a recurring theme of rewriting a narrative for yourself to live by. People who write fictions for themselves, either to live with who they are or to get what they want or to, justify some action they took. I was thinking of several stories in there, Two Boys and a Girl and Hunters in the Snow. Do you think that's accurate? Do you think people construct worlds in their heads that they can use to justify the way they are in the world?
Yes, and, most of the stories here, they're not actually writing anything. It's all being, these are psychological constructions that are done, I think, instinctively. I think we all do that. How do people, there are a lot of people in this world who are living on pretty comfortable terms with some pretty horrible things that they do day by day. Well, how do they do that? And they create a world in which they're actually not villains, but heroes. And I think that, again, to a much lesser extent, obviously, we all do that. We make some accommodation with the world, with our own natures, try to see ourselves as agents of good in the world that we inhabit, and we may well be, but we all shade we all shade the portrait of ourselves to some extent in a flattering way, I think we do that even without meaning to.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's why so many of these stories were so resonant. You know, even if you can't relate to the particulars, I certainly related to the underlying themes in so many of them. I know you've said that you don't have any theories about the short story, but just theories of the particular stories you write. So, you know, without giving in too much to too much generalization, I was hoping to have a little discussion about the short story form and contrast it to the novel and perhaps compare it a bit more to poetry. Aside from matters of merely length and compression of language, it strikes me that the short story is trying to accomplish something very different than the novel. What appeals to you about the short story form?
Well, a number of things, but to begin with, we're talking about the short story today because I happen to have a collection of short stories out, but I do not put the short story on some sort of ladder above the novel. I love novels. I've written a couple. I intend to write more, and each of these forms has its beauties. Mm. One of the things that has been said about the novel is that it is a prose narrative of a certain length that has something wrong with it. Well, I can think of a few novels of which that's not true. Marguerite Duras' The Lover, William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow, Heart of Darkness, if you want to call that a novel. Mm. Probably All Quiet on the Western Front. I don't think there's a moment in that that I would change. Mm. I could go on naming novels that seem pretty perfect to me. Mm. Great Gatsby. But they all seem to have in common that they're pretty short, the ones that I can think of in that way. In other words, the possibility of control that's offered by a shorter form allows for a kind of perfection that a long, relaxed form, such as is used by, say, Updike in his Rabbit novels, mm-hmm. Digression is not only, allowed, but it's almost necessary to give the reader relief from the kind of relentlessness of the narrative. So there's a kind of meandering quality that I think is natural to the novel, especially as it was first written in very long forms. And as we see in novels like, say, Moby Dick, which is a great novel, but also in its own way rather a bad novel. I mean, its greatness is in its reach and its language and this amazing story it tells. It's a very badly conducted novel. It's very sloppy. The narrator forgets that he's a character in a novel and starts speaking as Melville for like 150 pages, then he seems to remember and go back into his character. Little things like that. He loses his sense of purpose in the conduct of the novel, that kind of thing. Well, you can't do that in a short story. You just can't do it. And there are a great many short stories that it seemed to me actually offer the prospect of a perfect thing. If you think of, say, Joyce's The Dead or Chekhov's Lady with Pet Dog, Flannery O'Connor's Good Country People, Catherine Ann Porter's Theft, Flowering Judas, any number of her stories, Holiday. These are really, really, I think, perfect stories. They're as perfect as a snowflake, and you can do that with a short story. I could name Carver's Cathedral. I could name stories all day that seem to me to attain that kind of perfection. And perhaps part of what draws a writer like me to the short story form is that sense that, you know, though everything else in your life is out of control, that you can't perfect anything. You can't perfect your marriage. You can't perfect your kids. You can't perfect anything else. Maybe this thing you can make perfect, you know?
And, 20 pages, yeah.
Yeah, not that you'd want to perfect living things or living relationships. I'm making a joke, but But nevertheless, the sense of control that we, you know, that is so lacking in a great part of our lives seems to be offered by this. The other thing I really love about the short story is, how can I put it? It's at its best, there's a profound trust of the reader involved. There's a deep communion with the reader that is assumed by the best short story writers, that the readers, just as smart as you are, can get anything you tell them without having it explained to them. And so at its best, the short story represents an art of profound implication, where the reader is trusted from this arc of a person passing just in front of their eyes for that moment, or a relationship, a set of circumstances just passing right in front of their eyes without before or after accounted for, as in, say, one of Tolstoy's stories, which are written like small novels, you know, like The Death of Ivan Illich. He takes him from his birth to his death. We get the whole thing. No, in the art of the short story, as the writers like Chekhov and Joyce practice it, it's a set glimpse, but it is so, there's so much kind of submerged material that the reader can intuit from the way the story is constructed, that the reader actually has an imaginative understanding of what came before and what comes after, that the reader is sent on a kind of journey that the story itself doesn't actually cover in so many words, but somehow creates in the reader's mind through the power of implication and all the embedded significances that are possible to be created in this form. It's wonderful, though. I mean, look at, you know, a famous example of this sort of thing is Hemingway's Hills Like White Elephants. It's just a conversation between two people at a railroad station, but by the end of it, you have a very good sense of where this relationship is going, and by little signals here and there, where it's been and what the issue is between them. And, I mean, that's an exemplary instance of the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because that is, as I was thinking about your short stories and short stories in particular, and comparing them to poetry, that's kind of the sense I get from poetry as well. It's this juxtaposition of images and the language itself that evokes much more than what's on the page. And unlike the novel that seems like it's telling a story through, you know, plot and what happens to people and their kind of meandering ways, short stories, by bringing up an object that's totally unrelated to the rest of the story, or panning the camera away from the main action at the end of the story, you're left with this unsettling feeling as the reader, and a sense that so much else has happened that wasn't spelled out for you.
Exactly.
And it takes more work, perhaps. You were talking in an interview about why Americans perhaps don't read short stories, when it would, you know, maybe be more conducive to our quick lifestyle. But the attention the short story takes, and the attention poetry takes, and why we've, maybe it's not entered the mass market as much as novels.
No, and it's, I think it's always been so. I'm not sure this is a tectonic shift of any kind. There was a time that nostalgists like to appeal to when there were hundreds of slick magazines, commercial magazines, that printed short stories, and what happened to the short story and all that sort of thing. You know, the cry goes up. Well, the truth is, if you actually look, as I have, at those magazines, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, even to the early 50s, before television co-opted the writers of those stories, they're mostly genre, almost all of them. They're genre stories. They're very contrived and formulaic, as indeed they're intended to be. The same way when you go into a McDonald's, you go in there precisely because you know what you're going to get. A reader of Collier's or Mercury or the Saturday Evening Post in the old days, when they picked up a short story in there, they knew exactly what it was going to be like, and that's why they picked it up. The literary short story, though, has been written and read by, you know, always a number of people, relatively small compared to those who read novels. And partly for the reason you say. It's a little more demanding. A really fine story is not probably a casual read, though it should be. I think it should excite interest and pleasure on a first reading, even if it doesn't open itself up entirely on a first reading, and requires a little more attention than that. Mm-hmm. Most novels don't. Again, there are literary novels, of course, that do, but the kinds of novels that we read, ironically, because we're said to have very close or very short attention spans these days, the most popular novels are great big fat long.
Yeah.
And it's because people like to return to the same world every day and relax in the warm bath of the familiar, and a short story collection doesn't offer that pleasure. It's a continual collision with the unfamiliar. And, you know, you finish one story and you're in another world, another set of characters, another set of challenges for the reader. Some readers love that. I'm one. Some don't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Most don't.
I was thinking about your news stories, and it felt somewhat apparent to me in reading the collection of news stories that the war and what effects warfare have on the psychology have kind of perhaps been on your mind. Is that on your mind, or is that just me projecting onto you?
There are a couple of stories that register, no doubt, my sort of thinking about where we are right now and my memories of where I once was. But, we don't live in a vacuum. And this war, now 5 years old, that we're in is having all kinds of consequences, and not just on soldiers, but on our civic life and our discourse and everything else. And I write out of the atmosphere and milieu of this country. I'm a very American writer, and so inevitably this is going to show up. I'm not interested in presenting the reader with a rant about these things, but I'm kind of interested in exploring the personal consequences of a lot of what's going on in our national life right now. And that's always, I think, what writers are interested in anyway, is what happens to the human person, not just what happens physically to somebody as a result of being in a war. That has been adequately handled by even non-literary writers can present you with an inventory of the physical harms that can befall you. But I'm very interested in the kind of psychological consequences. For example, how a good person, given power and plunged, given the power of authority and weaponry, all that sort of thing, maybe a 19-year-old, what happens when that person is put in a place where he can't tell the difference between the people who he moves through and who he's afraid of? And does that turn you into a bully without your even realizing it, though you started off idealistically and as a kind, compassionate person? What are the transformations that an experience like that can enact? And are we aware of that when we send people off into these situations? You know, we're continually talking about our fine, brave young men and women in uniform, and so they are when we send them off. But what are they like when they come home?
Mm-hmm.
What is the damage, not just to their bodies and to their spirits, but to their characters, that this kind of thing can enact? Well, there's one story that kind of explores that a bit, but not directly.
Not directly.
It's through a mother's concern. And so I'm not trying to write propaganda, but I'm trying to reflect on what's happening to us as a result of the way we're all living now, and the policies that are enacted in our name and with our money and evidently with our consent. I'm just very interested in how we're going to look after all this is over.
And nothing comes across as propaganda at all in this. It's just very haunting you know, leaves you with a lot of haunting thoughts. I should remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Tobias Wolff, author. His latest short story collection is Our Story Begins. And I do want to give you just an opportunity to read to us for a couple of minutes, because listeners should get an opportunity to hear your voice in this.
All right. Why don't I read the beginning of... you know what I'll do? I think I'm going to read... We've talked so much about the American... character in here. I'm going to, all the stories are set in this country except one. One is set in Italy, in Rome, and I think I'll read from the beginning of that story just for a little variety.
Perfect.
It's a story called The Benefit of the Doubt. The number 64 bus stops at St. Peter's, so it's always crammed with pilgrims or suckers, depending on your point of view. A happy hunting ground for pickpockets. Mallon was not a pilgrim, nor by his own reckoning a sucker. His estranged wife was Swiss-Italian. He spoke the language fluently and came to Rome often on agency business, and was on the 64 bus that day, a thief's hand in his pocket, only because he had an appointment near the Vatican and got caught in a flash summer downpour with no cabs in sight. The bus was packed with wet, steamy people. They swayed into one another at the stops and turns, and it was during one of these mash-ups that Mallon felt the hand casing his rear pockets, both empty. His billfold, passport tucked inside, was buttoned into the breast pocket of his suit jacket. The touch was heavy, crude. Before he could turn... I'm sorry, that's my dog. Quiet! Hey, hey, quiet! Cat, get the dog! I'm sorry.
No worries.
He was in the room with me, and now he's... I have sound effects for my stories. You didn't notice that, did you, when you were reading them?
Catherine! Catherine! Get the dog, please!
So I start again?
You know,
it's a little late, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
Well, you know,
maybe
this is the wonderful thing about live radio, isn't it?
I love live radio.
You never know what's going to happen.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I love it.
I didn't know that the dog was in the room with me.
He's engaged with your short story.
Well, I should have written him in. then there wouldn't be any problem. You want me to go on?
Please do. Please.
Okay. Okay. All right. He's got a pickpocket's hand in his... pocket. The touch was heavy, crude. Before he could turn and give the thief a warning look, the hand slid into his right front pocket. The blatancy of the move was astonishing, executed with no more finesse than if Mallon himself had done it, diving for some change. The hand went in, and damn if it didn't stay in. This pocket was empty too, but the hand seemed unwilling to accept the fact. Mallon became curious as to just how long this could go on. There was a lulling detachment in observing such ineptitude at work, a safe, dreamy amusement. The air was warm, swampy. The bus stopped to take on still more passengers, and the thief was pressed up against Mallon's back. His hand continued to burrow around like a mouse nosing for crumbs. So that's the beginning of that story.
Fabulous.
And his encounter with this pickpocket is the propellant of the story and carries him to a place that he hadn't anticipated, as so many of our encounters do.
As so many of these stories do. Yeah, and as much of life does. That's wonderful. That was Tobias Wolff reading from the short story, The Benefit of the Doubt, which is included in Our Story Begins. His latest
Tobias book. Wolff and his dog, Patty.
And his dog, Patty. who was most thrilled with the reading as well. I love that. You know, before we go out, I'm wondering if you can leave us with advice, words of wisdom, things you tell your own students as they go down this journey path of writing.
Well, it all comes down in the end, I think, to being patient with yourself. I mean, you have it or you don't, and if you do have it, you will work at it and work very hard at it. The greatest danger for those who actually have the possibility of becoming writers is that they will become so impatient with the kind of transitional stages of their work, just the difficulty of writing up to their own expectations, that they will become frustrated and beat themselves up to a point where they really inhibit their own gift. Just know that as when you're learning an instrument or anything of difficulty like that, it's a war won by tiny little battles, one after another, and you just stay in the game. You just keep at it. You gnaw away at it.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting philosophy, that you either have it or you don't. And I wonder at what point.
Well, I mean,
what point you know.
You don't. I as a teacher, I never know that. That's something. The having it. I that's kind of a shorthand for a whole constellation of things. I mean, I suppose there has to be some gift there. I can't imagine somebody ever becoming a writer who has no gift at all. But I can tell you that people that I would not have expected when I first started teaching to become writers, though I tried to help them as best I can, have become very famous writers, and it's because they just stayed with it, and whatever gift they had, they gave it the full range of opportunities to blossom by being at work with it and not beating themselves up and coming back again and again. So, you know, this patience and determination is about 99% of it, I think.
Yeah, dogged perseverance.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was really wonderful. I so appreciate your time and your dog's time. And this was great. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Tobias Wolff, author of many things, but most recently his short story collection, Our Story Begins, available now and published by Knopf. Tobias will be at the LA Times Festival of Books this Sunday on a panel entitled Serious Prose. It appears to already be sold out, so you'll find me in the standby line. But if you have an opportunity, do see him there. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. John Burnham Schwartz will be with me for the second half hour, so bear with me for a very brief break. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine.
If a Middle Earth elf lived today in Southern California, how would she celebrate and support the arts, music, and her community? What would Arwen do? Thursdays with me, Tani Tenuvio, on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live at KUCI.org. Alin Salalumin Amenti Elfo. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes public radio page or Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. Again, I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara, and I'm here now with John Burnham Schwartz. John is the author of the novels Clara Marvel, Bicycle Days, and Reservation Road, which was made into a motion picture based on his screenplay starring Joaquin Phoenix, Mark Ruffalo, and Jennifer Connelly. His books have been translated into more than 15 languages, and his writing has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times and The New Yorker. But it is his latest novel, The Commoner, that examines life behind the walls of the Imperial House of Japan, and we'll talk about it this morning. John, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you on. I think it's best to start with an introduction to the book and how you became interested in the subject matter.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that I actually majored in Japanese studies at Harvard. I graduated way back in 1987, and 20 years ago, or a little more. And so I had already, by the time I graduated from college, spent about 3 years intensely immersed in study of pretty much all aspects of Japan, the language as well. And when I was 21, sort of between May and the end of September, I spent almost 5 months living there, working for an American company and living with a Japanese family, none of whom spoke any English. And so that the sort of basis that became the basis for my what became my first novel eventually, Bicycle Days, which was published when I was 24 in 1989. But then I have to say that novel and the writing of it kind of charted both the start of and the life of a kind of crush on the on the culture, if you will, and also to some degree. By the time the writing was done, the sort of end of that crush, there were certain things that, you know, I encountered in Japan or more observed, really, that did not, you know, correspond, like all crushes, with the ideal version I had in my head. And so I kind of just naturally kind of drifted away from Japan for quite some time. I was living in Europe then in my 20s, and I wrote two more books and did a lot of other things. But around the middle of the 90s, I had become aware that Masako Owada, who had actually been 2 years ahead of me at Harvard, though I'd never known her, had married the Crown Prince in 1993, which was, I don't know, for anybody who sort of knew even a little bit about that world and had heard about her a little bit and how international she was, speaking, you know, five languages and growing up all over the world, there was just a sort of shock of disappointment or even depression that associated that her saying yes to that. Mm-hmm. And that was in the back of my mind when in 1995 my great aunt, who was then in her 80s, she's almost 96 now, and a legendary children's book publisher still working, came back from Japan. Yeah, she's quite amazing. And I just saw her last weekend. She came back from a trip to Japan in which she had been invited to have lunch alone with the Empress. And the reason for that was she had published two books of translations that the Empress had made of a famous Japanese poet for children. The Empress had loved the books and, through an intermediary, had invited my aunt. My aunt, you know, expected that there would be many other people around. In fact, you know, there was no one, including the servants. I mean, everyone was sent out of the room, and this is very unusual.
Wow.
And for about 2 hours, you know, my aunt as my aunt recounted it to me, you know, outside of an initial sort of voluntary admission that the Empress made that, you know, she had lost her voice in the early 60s and suffered, you know, something of a breakdown, which I think she probably mentioned because she assumed my aunt would have heard it. She really spent the whole time very kind of politely and gracefully but insistently sort of interviewing my aunt about her life. One question after another about a woman whose life could not have been more different in any way from her own, you know, a person who had her own career, her own life, traveled all over on her own, was incredibly satisfied with her professional life, didn't marry until she was in her 50s, never had children, was still working. A real independent life, very much an American life in some ways. And my aunt came back and she said it was almost as if the Empress were sort of imaginatively investigating, you know, a life that under completely different circumstances might have been her own.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just that idea, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, that was 12 years ago and 13 years ago. And it was something, you know, it's sort of like I think when you're told that someone has passed away and that there's still this heartbeat that, you know, is still going on the screen. You just hear this, or, you know, someone's been buried alive and you're just waiting for a sound. And there's just this idea for me, and maybe this is the, you know, the novelist metaphor, the novelist looking for a metaphor out there for what he does. But the idea that there was this imagination still inside that place that, for all intents and purposes, even from the outside, would appear to have been a place that nurtured no life. And somehow she couldn't quite let go of the imagination, which is what we know about ourselves, actually.
Right.
The question is, what is the story about that? And that's something that over time, after I went on and wrote another book, I eventually came back to, and that's when the hard work began.
Yeah. For the listeners who don't know as much about the life behind the these doors, perhaps just a description of that.
I will. Well, one has to start, really, since we are in the age of YouTube. It's truly hard. I just come back from a few months on the road on book tour, and I have to say again and again, the thing that it's hardest for people really to grasp about the imperial family is that in this age in which basically anything you do can appear, you know, on the web within about 15 minutes, these are people whose inner lives, in every single respect, will never be known to anyone in the outside world. There will never be, never have been, and I feel quite confident in saying there never will be, any, you know, pieces, parts of letters that will appear in a magazine or a book, any letters themselves, any off-the-cuff remarks made by anybody, any of the core members of the imperial family, the emperor and empress, the crown princes, the crown princesses, no unofficial photographs. There was one published of the second prince some years ago after his marriage, and that photographer, as far as I know, never worked again. All of the press conferences that are made, the questions are vetted by the mainstream press. Questions from the mainstream press are vetted by the Imperial Household Agency, which now numbers about 1,100 people. In the old days, before the war, when that agency was made up entirely of the aristocratic families, the old noble families, there were about 5,000 people. They regulate in every way what the members of the imperial family do say, and how they run their lives, you know, at any hour of the day. So really, it's just this idea that there are probably, you know, a handful of people in the world who know anything. They live beyond the moat. There's a 240-acre palace in the middle of Tokyo. It's surrounded literally by the stone ramparts and the moat. Beyond that moat, there are just these people, and no one who knows anything will ever speak. And I can say that quite authoritatively, since in fact I managed through all of my connections to end up having lunch with the Grand Chamberlain to the Emperor a few years ago when I went over there to do research.
Wow.
And none of my journalist friends in Tokyo could believe that he was meeting with me because they had been there for years and never seen him alone. He runs every, you know, he's just probably the second ranking person in the Imperial Household Agency. And the reason, of course, he showed up to see me was because what I was doing, what he'd been told he was doing by my contact who had written him a letter, was, you know, writing a novel, as the Grand Chamberlain put it to me. He said, you are writing a novel about the Japanese imperial family, but not about the actual Japanese imperial family. This was an idea that somehow I think he found a little interesting. It's never been done, you know, in mm-hmm. Japan. And no, I mean, what I would say is it's a deeply sympathetic portrait of a woman who is empress. I mean, it's a novel. It's not this woman. Though certainly her story is based on the life of the current empress and also of the crown princess, and but it is very sympathetic, but it's a Western act of sympathy. No Japanese would do it.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting that I know Ben Hills wrote a book on Princess Misako.
Yes.
A biography. And
yes, I read that book.
He's certainly been in a bit of hot water with
them. Yeah, he's had about half a dozen death threats. It's interesting that we talk about this today because I actually just received an email from my foreign agent with the news that there was, much to my surprise, an auction for the rights to The Commoner in Japan among a couple of publishers, and one publisher, you know, outbid the other one, and it's now going to be published and translated into Japanese.
Wow.
And that coincides also, I just gave an interview to a big magazine last week, which I guess will come out in a couple of weeks. I find this very surprising. I was quite sure that they were never going to publish it.
Right.
And so I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
But I think the last thing to say is that this family is the oldest, longest-running, and most cloistered family, imperial family, certainly in the world, but really of any family that I can think of. It traces its lineage back directly through the male line, so they say. I mean, you know, God knows how many concubines along the way, but... back almost 1,600 years to the beginning of recorded time in Japan. And actually, in mythic terms, on beyond that, into the sort of murk of the beginning of Japan, and, you know, the emperor is supposed to be descended directly from the sun goddess Amaterasu Omikami. And so, while for most of the history of the office of the emperor was really mostly, at some level considered to be a sort of guardian, in a way, of the cultural and even racial purity of the Japanese. In 1869, in the 19th century, when Japan opened to the West, a group of politicians around the emperor got together and helped to write a new constitution, or the first constitution. And it was at that time that the emperor then was raised to become a deity, a god, which in fact he was right up until 1946 in January, when, having lost the war at MacArthur's demand, the emperor got on the radio and had to announce in his own voice that he was, in fact, not a god. He had spent his entire life as a god. I know it sounds funny. You just have to bear with me. This is true. And that he was, in fact, not a god, but a man. Now, I happen to know, or I've spoken to a couple of Japanese who were around at that time, and you would have, had you been in the country, especially in the countryside, you would have seen people all over the country falling to their knees at the sound of his voice and what he was saying. First of all, because none of them had ever heard his voice before. Secondly, I think many of them probably didn't even know that he had a voice the way we have a voice. And the whole thing was inconceivable. And what does all this have to do with the story as it comes in The Commoner, which begins in the 30s when this woman is born and really runs much through the rest of the century into her 70s, is that the real empress, Michiko Shoda, and my empress, Haruko Endo, when they, in 1959, having had a normal childhood, privileged, of course, but normal,
mm-hmm.
much like any of ours, with schools and friends and, you know, silly mistakes and secrets and everything else, and parents. When she crossed, married the crown prince, the first of her kind to do so, first commoner, and crossed over the moat and effectively disappeared from life, her father-in-law that day, the man who became her father-in-law, was, of course, Hirohito, the emperor who we know to have presided in some fashion over the war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He didn't die until 1989, by the way, which I think most people thought he was dead decades before.
In the 60s, yeah.
But that was 19 years ago. He, when he became her father-in-law, was only 13 years removed from being a god.
Wow.
That's what he had spent his entire life being. And so that's really the only way I can try and suggest what it was that she entered into.
It's just amazing.
It is. And, you know, she had a breakdown in the early 1960s. She lost her voice for 7 months. The crown princess aside, she's hardly been seen in public for, you know, over 4 years and has suffered many depressions. The empress, who's now in her 70s, I read in the Times about a year ago, had to cancel a long trip because she was found to be, you know, bleeding from the nose, the mouth, and internally due to stress, which clearly sounds like another breakdown some 40 years after, you know, the first one. Mm. So that's just, you know, I mean, I'll just say this. I mean, I've been asked, well, why didn't you write about the men? Well, the men are in the novel. There are men in the novel, absolutely, her husband and the crown princess's husband and others. But the truth is, what really interested me and what has elicited my greatest compassion is the lives of those who were born outside, who were not born to this.
Right, right.
You know?
Who knew because something different.
Again, you go back to that idea of the imagination. You know, what do you do with that? What do you do with your memories, which in fact are at some level going to become the only thing you have to live on?
Right, right. It's interesting that I hadn't realized that she lost her voice in actuality, because it seems like that's just the perfect writing metaphor for what happened to this woman. Is she, you know, she literally and figuratively lost her voice. So I had erroneously right. assumed that was, you know, kind of a metaphoric device.
That's the danger in real life sometimes, where things are too metaphorically perfect. And I actually had to look at it for a while and try and persuade myself that I could. It seems so apt, in a sense, that I had to persuade myself that I could make it just messy enough.
Right.
That it, you know, that it didn't seem like a made-up gimmick.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with John Burnham Schwartz, author of several things, but most recently The Commoner. I don't want to delve, you know, into inappropriate or prurient material here, but as I was reading your book, briefly alluded to this and little internet research kind of confirmed it,
mm-hmm.
that until recently there was somebody who came by and drew, you know, blood and urine and stools, I don't know, from the royal family. And it struck me that at the moment when things are so guarded and you can't have a letter or a photograph that it escapes mm-hmm. the palace walls, there's also this intimate hyper-attention, hyper-paranoia surrounding the family, and,
yeah.
you know, all attention is obviously focused on the women's fertility and,
right.
and procreation. And I don't know if all of these blood draws and everything are you know, trying to make sure the genetic line is pure or something, but I was curious.
I think there's still a lot of that. I mean, this is the whole notion of the role of the emperor and the empress and their children is still a very loaded one in Japan. And, I mean, this is proven by the fact that it was just about a year and a half ago that the second prince, somebody who, you know, a character that I did not put into my novel, really, because I sort of imagined this would happen. And I didn't, to me, it wasn't really the story, in a sense, that I thought was most interesting. But he and his wife ended up giving birth many years after their last children, who were girls, were born, to a boy a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. Now, this was, the most significant thing to happen within the royal family in half a century, practically. And
because the Crown Princess had not been able to get pregnant for years and then finally had given birth through artificial means, although this, of course, was not reported in Japan, as it never is. She gave birth to a girl, not a boy, and nobody had had boys, and the diet was being pressed by more modern types to change the laws to allow the little girl, who's now, I think, seven, to one day rule. When the younger brother, for whatever motivations, finally went back to the drawing board, also I think through artificial means, and gave birth to a boy, the diet, the pressure on the diet disappeared, basically ensuring that all the women in the palace now are going to be frozen in their lives and their positions for probably another 75 years, including, you know, the little, the children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, the blood-taking, I mean, I think what it points to is two things. One is this obsession with the lineage at a time when it seemed like that was about to get out of control in the minds of the sort of ultra-nationalists and the old guard,
uh-huh.
a couple of whom have been prime minister, by the way. And the other thing is just what the women are subjected to. I mean, there's a scene in the book about what the crown princess, who becomes empress, is subjected to at the time of her marriage, the fertility tests, the, you know, rubbing of her stomach with sacks of rice bran, and, you know, all these sort of ancient rituals that are meant, the ritual on the wedding night with the eating of the omochi, which are the rice cakes. Everything is meant to, within the realm of ancient tradition, to supposedly encourage the birth not just of a child but of a male.
Right.
And it just, you know, people keep saying, well, how can this still go on this way? And, you know, is it going to continue? And haven't they changed, the new emperor and all that? And my response, based on all of my research, is, I mean, is Akihito different from Hirohito? Well, yes, I think he's certainly a more worldly man, and he's more contemporary, but really, what's changed?
Yeah.
He was the first emperor ever to stop at a red light, first emperor ever to drive himself. I mean, I believe he was the first emperor ever to do away with the role of the job of the imperial stool analyzer. So there's a man out there who needs a job.
Who needs a job.
Right. So it's really hard to fathom. But there are people living in there. And as extreme as the situation is and seems, to me, you know, writing the novel, trying to investigate what those lives might be like, you begin to find human correlations all over the place that maybe might surprise you. Correlations between these imprisoned women and any women who find themselves in some way to have had their narratives robbed from them. These are people who can be in a family, in a marriage, people who, of course, may themselves be in an actual prison, any number of situations that seem perhaps much less extreme and more everyday, and yet at the same time, there are connections to be made between how a person keeps one's imagination and one's spirit going without being able to tell their story.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
Yeah.
John, this was a huge pleasure.
Well, thanks. I really enjoyed
it.
Talking to you.
Me too. That was John Burnham Schwartz, author of The Commoner, available now and published by Doubleday. John will be at the LA Times Book Festival this weekend at UCLA. He's appearing on a panel entitled Fiction, Stories of the Far East on Saturday. Tickets may still be available, so feel free to see him there or visit his website, johnburnhamschwartz.com. Anne Rice had this to say about her writing, "Writers write about what obsesses them. You draw those cards. I lost my mother when I was 14. My daughter died at the age of 6. I lost my faith as a Catholic. When I'm writing, the darkness is always there. I go where the pain is." Barbara will be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day.